I want to go see a cabaret show that I feel like if someone else sang that entire exact same set list, it would feel wrong.
Hey, everybody. You're listening to the Voracious Student Podcast. I'm your host, Denis Lambert. And each week I'll be bringing on a new guest teacher to discuss life and the arts. The art we are talking about today is cabaret, and I have Amy Jo Jackson on the show to discuss it. If you've ever been lucky enough to be in the audience for one of Amy Jo's shows, you know they are a singular, ferociously talented cabaret artist. And in the episode, you're going to learn all about Amy Jo's work. I do want to say, because we're focusing this episode purely on cabaret, that one of my very favorite moments of the episode is when Amy Jo says that they are no longer going to define themselves in disparate categories. Amy Jo is an actor and a singer, a dialect coach, and is writing, and those all go together, and that putting yourself in boxes is exhausting. So I just want to say that I love that idea, and we just happen to be focusing on cabaret in this episode. I love cabaret. I love going to cabaret shows. I love doing them. I've done 3 solo acts and 1 duo act, and I think 2 of them were true cabarets, and 2 of them were concert/cabarets. And if you don't know what I mean by that, Amy Jo and I are going to talk all about that. We talk about a lot. This is the 2nd longest episode we've released, so let's dive in. As someone who has done so much cabaret, and you went to school for musical theater.
I did.
You did. That's another podcast. Do you feel like conventional acting and singing prepares someone to do cabaret? Do you think there are other skills that need to be learned? And is there any way to learn them other than by doing it?
Yes, but and also... You know what I mean? Like, obviously, there's many different kinds of cabaret. I have, like, Charles Bush did one of the best cabarets I've ever seen. And I think he sang maybe 4 songs, you know, because that's not what Charles Bush is delivering in the Charles Bush experience. Like, for me, I'm doing a very vocal heavy cabaret. So, yes, it is very useful that I have trained for many years singing. But I would say the things that prepped me most to do cabaret that I didn't obviously realize at the time would be really a useful translation are doing Shakespeare in small spaces and working with a company called Exit Pursued by a Bear, where we did shows basically in apartments. And so you're literally in people's laps. There's no wondering like, gee, I wonder where Lin-Manuel is sitting tonight. You're like, oh, he's right in the seat that I have to fall on top of and die. So that'll happen in 45 minutes. Like you have to acknowledge that and move through it really quickly. Like one of the shows I did with Exit Pursued by a Bear was called Danny Girl. It was a musical where I didn't have a ton to do until this like big number 3/4 of the way through the show. Very emotional. And the way that my body was angled, I would always be looking at one of the VIP couches that they'd sit people on. So night after night, it's like, all right, you have to deal with the fact that you have to like live through this emotional experience and like be very present and like tears streaming down your face while trying to belt, while basically trying not to make eye contact with Sigourney Weaver. Like you just have to like acknowledge these things and move forward. And the combination of that, being used to being in very close proximity to audience members, literally stepping over legs that are like you could move your legs, folks. You see, we're acting in this very small space. Okay, fine. You know, like getting used to that kind of like the audience is going to do what the audience is going to do in very close proximity to you. And then doing Shakespeare where there's so much direct address. And I've done a lot of Shakespeare in small spaces or outdoors where there's not like afternoon Shakespeare, shall we call it, where it's like you can see them. They can see you seeing them. And I think a lot of actors are really terrified of like making eye contact with an audience member. Like if it happens by accident, it's like an electric shock, you know? And with cabaret, I think that's one of the most useful tools you have is like being willing to like look a person in the eye, and like deliver a line to them. Like the fourth wall is blurrier in cabaret, even if sometimes you're singing a really emotional song. There are times when I'll do songs directly where like I'm looking at a spot on the wall. I'm giving you a classic musical theater audition room technique, you know, where I'm like, I'm using the fourth wall for this number. But there are many other times where it's like, I'm clearly like in the body of the song talking to one person, but that one person has to be distributed among the individual audience members that are there. Cabaret is very intimate. Even if you're in like a big space, that's part of what I think a lot of people like about it, is it feels like a singular kind of night. Maybe things happen this night that wouldn't happen if you came on another night. And it's, you're there. You're like in there, they're in the same room with you, and that exchange is acknowledged. So I think that the vocal technique, while obviously like important, there are many cabaret artists who I would not say like singing or singing is like the big draw of them. Like Bridget Everett, who I think is one of the most well-known like alt cabaret artists in the game, who is just tremendous. She has an enormous instrument. She can sing like a beast, but only really, I've seen a few different shows of hers. She'll only really open it up and let you like enjoy the voice every now and again. And it's not in, and I don't mean that in like a Kelly O'Hara kind of reserve kind of way. There is nothing reserved about Bridget Everett, but for her, it's much more about just like screwing with the audience. You do not sit on the front row at a Bridget Everett show unless you want to be deeply involved in, and like, so like she builds this relationship with specific people in the audience. She gives them fake names. She's like talking to them all night. And the singing is just part of that, like, interaction is just part of that whole experience. The singing is just kind of there to aid it. She's not really showing off the vocals. She's showing off the entire human experience. I don't know. So yes, I think it's useful, but I think there are a lot of different ways to hone that aspect of working cabaret. Nightlife, hosting, doing a lot of comedy gigs, that also is really helpful. Just like working a crowd that is not necessarily like quiet and docile in the way that like it would be more likely to be at like a Broadway show.
Totally. And I remember before I did mine, I went and watched a couple, and I was, my big takeaway from seeing a couple different shows was that there's no real rules. I mean, this can in a way be anything you want it to be.
One of the things that I am most interested in when I'm going to see cabaret, I mean, this obviously feeds into like what I do when I'm building a show, but like I'm someone who loves the form. So I love to see other people do it. I want to go see a cabaret show that I feel like if someone else sang that entire exact same set list, it would feel wrong somehow. Where like, I want to feel like I'm watching something that could only have come out of that person's brain. I want to see something that feels incredibly surprising and yet completely inevitable when you look back on it. My favorite moments in cabaret shows are like, oh, how did they think about that? How did they think to do that? And how did I not see it coming? Charles Bush, I think of, he did this ridiculous number in his act where he's about halfway through the show. He's in his like full drag, like, you know, lady character. And about halfway through, he's like, okay, it's time for me to take a little break. You've all been watching this like wonderful music director of mine play the piano, and it's time to give him a chance to shine. And like, that's a common thing that people will do, bring a guest up or have the music director, just breaking it up a little bit, give you a chance to take a break or do a costume change. So like Charles Bush sits on a stool in the middle of the stage, and the lights go down on him and up on the music director, who starts singing like a very charming version of, I think it was Someone to Watch Over Me. And as it goes along, I begin to realize the lights aren't down on Charles Bush. They are lower than they would be if he were sitting there, like singing the song himself. He starts to like do all these bits that are basically like, oh, I thought the song was, oh, it's still going on. Oh, I better be quiet and sit here. Oh, look, there's someone in the audience. We better be quiet. You're giving him his moment. And then like playing around with his feather boa and like the feather boa getting stuck in his mouth. And him, like, it becomes this hilarious comic Lotsy of him just like, then like his eyelash is like coming off, all the stuff that's clearly like the character is like, I want to be singing again. Why is this guy still singing? But like, it's like such an old, like, I've seen that, but I've never seen it done that well and run through that character that he was doing. And at that point in the show, and that's the kind of thing that I was like, I can't believe I didn't know this was coming the instant that this like drag queen was like, oh, now I'm going to give someone else a chance to sing. Like, how did I miss it? And yet it was continually delightful and so in the style of this like comic genius. So like that can happen in so many different ways, which is part of what makes cabaret exciting and a little slippery, I think.
Mm-hmm. Totally. What you said about it being surprising and inevitable, mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like that's what you're so unbelievably successful in when I see
Thank you
in your show. You're very welcome. It feels like nobody else, like the Tennessee Williams show, for example, like no one else would do this show. And if anyone else did, it just wouldn't work. So let's start there. So how did that show come about? What was it?
Great. Okay, so it's called The Brass Menagerie. My little log line for it is a campy romp through the women of Tennessee Williams in song. And I basically play 9 different Williams characters, as well as then there's a framing device of me being like an academic lecturer who's going to like take you through the plays and relate it all back to Williams and his relationships to his mother and his sister, you know, and then it's just absolutely absurd. For instance, like I do basically like Maggie from Cat in the Hot Tin Roof, her like Act 1 series of monologues, but I just musicalized and then not musicalized, the music existed. I did parody lyrics to a bunch of songs from Cats and made it all the stuff that happens in that first act. Like the day that I realized that Jellicle Cats scanned perfectly with Maggie the Cat, that
Maggie
was a good
the
day.
Cat. Yeah, Maggie.
I'm Maggie the Cat. Maggie the Cat, you Maggie the Cat. It's just, that's the level, you know? But it came about, like all good works of art, it started as a joke. I was sitting on the couch with my partner, and we were, like you do in a 2-actor household, we were talking about Ethel Merman. Oh, can you imagine if Ethel Merman played Amanda Wingfield? And Jeff goes, yeah, you could call it The Brass Menagerie. And then we just started doing bits, being like, oh, yeah, and you could do this and you could do that. And we're like, wait a minute, we might have something here. So I like started making a playlist, like the rose tattoo bit came out of that night of us sitting on the couch being like, yeah, you could just sing the rose, but in a heavy Italian accent. That's the joke. That's all it is. And then basically, I like always have too many ideas to execute even a third of them at once. So I kind of backburnered it. And then I saw an opportunity to apply for a cabaret residency through this thing called the Denovan Residency at the Duplex. And basically, they give you a small grant and then free rehearsal space once a week for 6 months at the Duplex. And that's, you end up spending so much money on rehearsal space. You know, I don't have a piano at my house. And also, even though I've been doing it for the last year, I do find it hard to work in my apartment, especially when it's like, I need to sing all of the beltiest songs in the canon at top volume. And, you know, it's better to do that in a rehearsal room. So that was a big draw. And then I got it. They do 2 residencies a year. And I got the first one. So I was like, well, shoot, I have to do it now, because it culminates in then a performance at the Duplex. And I had thought of the Duplex as a natural home for this piece. Different shows feel like they want to live in different venues, you know, and this is like super campy, like extremely like celebratory of the gay canon in many different ways. I was like, it feels like the Duplex is its natural home, or at least its natural first home, you know? So I started putting the show together and I realized I was going to have to do a lot more parody lyrics than I was originally intending if I wanted it to like live at the level that I wanted it to. As I started to assemble it, I was like, I think this will be much stronger if I basically rewrite as many lyrics as possible. And then that also means the lyrics that you don't rewrite hit harder in a particular, like I was rewriting all the stuff for The Glass Menagerie, which that's like the back third of the show. I basically do a condensed version of The Glass Menagerie playing all 3 Wingfield characters and set it all to the score of Gypsy. And so what was fun about that was how little I needed to change, really. Mm-hmm. I sang all of Little Lamb without changing a lyric. I changed as little as possible.
Did that surprise you?
I would say basically with that first, like the first idea of like Ethel Merman as Amanda Wingfield, as soon as I started looking at Gypsy, I was like, this is brilliant how much it just like hangs together. I would say it maybe surprised me at first and then was just like became a mad hunt to be like, how much of this score can I put in here? And then it was really exciting to see what revealed itself, like realizing that Rose's turn needed to actually be after the show proper was over and it needed to be Tennessee Williams' sister singing Rose's turn. Like those things as I was like, oh, this is what it is. It's the inevitability thing. It's more just like the more I worked on it, the more like realizing where the natural home of all those songs fit within that story. But it was really exciting, you know, it'd be like, I'd be on a cold Tuesday morning up at the duplex, like sitting behind the piano by myself. You know, they didn't have the heat on in the morning. And I'd be like wrapped in my coat and my hat with my coffee by my side and a little tired and just get like a real jolt of excitement as I was like, oh, this is so stupid. Yes. You know,
it's that amazing feeling when you know you're on the right track because everything is just, you know, falling into place. You were speaking about the duplex. Do you have a favorite venue in New York or does it depend on the show you're doing?
It depends on the show. I would say one of my favorite rooms to play is Feinstein's 54 Below. It's everything looks beautiful. It photographs and videos gorgeously, which is, you know, as like someone who doesn't have a huge following, like it's important. I need stuff to be able to put on YouTube. I've gotten jobs from YouTube, you know. It's very easy to play that room because of how they've laid the audience out. It feels very intimate, even if it's packed. And if it's not packed, it doesn't feel empty. You know, it just all, I really like the balance of the performer to audience vibe there. And I've performed there a lot. I would say it's my home club, but I do love performing at the duplex. There's just like a scrappiness to it and the history and also my own history of like, going there on a Friday night at midnight to sing at mostly Sondheim. And, you know, like there's just that kind of like New Yorkiness about it that I really love. I do love, I will say like one of my favorite like stages I've ever played was I was singing a couple of numbers on a variety show that my brother and his comedy partner put together at the Bell House. And that was very exciting. I was like singing with Josh and Aaron. My brother's a comedian, Aaron Jackson, and his comedy partner, Josh Sharp, also a wonderful comedian. And they were hosting this show called A Gay Show for All People. And we were doing a Freddie Mercury medley. And I was singing lead vocal in a black cat suit, as I want to do. And to do that, like, screamy rock music to a like sold out crowd at Bell House in Brooklyn, that felt pretty awesome. But like, I would not probably book myself a gig at the Bell House because I'm like, that's a tall order for the kind of gig I normally do. But for like that type of music, it's like, yeah, let's do Freddie Mercury at the Bell House. It just feels right, you know?
So what was the very first show you did?
It was in early September of 2014. It was self-titled. It was just Amy Jo Jackson at 54 Below. It predated the Slash. It predated the Feinstein's Slash part of 54 Below. And I called it basically like a concert cabaret hybrid because at that point I also wasn't so clear on like my own views on cabaret since I, you know, had never done it before, but I knew what I liked when I saw other people do stuff and I knew what I felt like I had to offer. And I feel like a lot of cabaret, not less so with something like the Brass Menagerie, but even with that, it's curation. You're curating an experience through the set list, how they flow into one another. Do you do an applause segue? Do you stop to do banter? Like, how do you set the audience up to continually be surprised? You know, where do you do your introduction? Do you do it after the first number? Do you do it after two? I did it that first night after two because I was like, I want them to immediately be like, oh, I thought I was going to get to hear you talk. No, you're going to do a little, now you're going to do a really intimate number. Interesting. But I basically wanted it to feel like a party I was throwing. It just happened to be at 54 Below. And the entertainment of the party is me. You know, I've hired myself to perform for you all. And it was really exciting. I definitely left the stage after that first time and felt like I was so unaware of how much time had passed, what had happened, my adrenaline. I don't know if you experienced this, like certainly the first time doing a cabaret show where you're like, I know that I did all those songs. So technically it must have been about X amount of time, but I feel like I left my body and came back to it. Like being on stage, very different than like walking off and walking back into the room to say hi to people. I was like, did I just do all of that? Where did I go? And that feeling has lessened over time as I've just gotten more used to it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's scary because there's so much prep.
Yeah.
And then if you only do one or two shows, it's like, I mean, I remember so clearly in my first show, I left the stage feeling like it was okay, but that one, there was this one song that I felt I just bombed. I was like, I just thought that was a disaster and I don't know what I did. And then of course, that was the song everyone told me was their favorite.
Yeah.
I love the show, but that's, and I was like, okay, okay. So I was actually onto something there that scared the shit out of me.
Yeah. So I'm like, I got to back away from the danger, which is perhaps my own brilliance.
Right.
I can't touch that.
Oh my God. That's another podcast as well. But I want to go back a bit because, you know, all the questions about curating, I'm really curious about that because I don't know if it was just your natural instinct or talent, but it feels like someone doing their first show might not know to ask themselves all those questions. Like, were you working with a director or did it just come naturally to you? Because I have also seen a lot of cabarets that none of that stuff was thought through. You know?
As have I. You know what? I will say I think there is a difference between someone who's interested in putting together a cabaret and someone who's interested in singing a night of nice music. And that's not to disparage the latter, but I don't think it's the same. And I don't think the point of cabaret, of me coming and watching someone sing an hour's worth of material, is to just hear you sing it nicely. I want to know your point of view about something, even if you don't explicitly state it to me. In fact, I'd prefer you didn't. I'd prefer that I get it from your set list, from the way that you present it to me, from how you're dressed, from how you choose to sing these songs. You know, are you doing a pretty straightforward version of it or are you subverting it in some way? And either one of those is totally fine. I do a lot of things where I'm not doing some kind of like arrangement that is all that out there of something, but I'm putting it in the set list in a particular way to have an effect, you know, to do something. So yeah, I don't know. You know, the first thing I ever did at 54 Below was I co-hosted a night, and I didn't put this together. I didn't produce it. It was through Jen Waldman Studios, but I co-hosted a night on like exploring gender. And I was like, sign me up to sing on this one, please. And then Jen had Emmett Rossland and I co-host. And so as co-hosts, we got to sing two songs. And I was kind of, I will say, surprised when I arrived and saw what most people were singing. And I would say, not everyone, but on the whole, most people were like singing songs they don't usually get to sing. And I was like, that's not an exploration of gender. Like you singing Being Alive, I've sung that at a wedding. Like Bernadette Peters very famously sang it. There's nothing in it that if someone doesn't know the show, they would think it's gendered in any way. I sang I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face. And then later in the night, Epiphany from Sweeney Todd. Like, I was like, I don't know. If I'm here, I want to like take a big swing and I have a point of view. So I think that that's always something that I've like been thinking about without necessarily being aware of the fact that I'm always interested in like, but why? Why am I going to bother to sit there and watch you sing something? Because you sing it nicely? Great. So does half of New York City. So I don't know. As I was putting that together, I was working with a director. I was working with a gentleman called Will Nunziata, and he and his brother are twins who have performed their own cabaret act for years, but he's also directed a lot of cabaret stuff. Basically, I met him through a gig I did at 54 Below, where I sang like one song on it. And then he reached out to me and was like, what are your thoughts on me helping you build an act around yourself? I was like, my thoughts are, how soon can we start?
Yes, please.
Yeah. And I will say like Will was very helpful as a director, but where I derived the most benefit from that relationship was in his capacity as a producer. Cause I didn't know how to do any of the, like the artistic stuff. I'm like, I know how to work on a song, but I was like, I don't know how I pitch this to a venue. What am I pitching? What do I need to tell them? Do they know who I am? He was like, I'm taking care of all of this. We're going to get you a date. They know me really well. They've seen you perform at a couple of one-off things at 54. We're going to get you a date. We'll set it 2 months in advance so you have time to prep, but not enough time to like, like stress too much. And we'll put a show together. And I I will say most of the set list ended up being stuff that was on my original playlist before I even like met with Will. I like had a bunch of playlists going. So he was really helpful in also getting me to like there. Oh gosh, what was it exactly? I think it was that like I would finish a song. This is when we'd be rehearsing. I would like finish a song and would immediately kind of like retreat back to more of a neutral kind of place to like, all right, now I'm going to go into the next thing. He's like, Will is so great. He'll do this thing where he'll just kind of get in your face to give you a real encouraging nugget. And he's like, you stand there and you take that applause and you stand it because you deserve it. And I was like, okay. But that was very valuable because I was like, you're right. I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that, am I? You know, even in a fictional situation, add a real applause to it. And it's going to be more like, okay, that's great. And all I got other stuff to stop that, you know, that kind of thing that as a performer, we're like longing for applause. And yeah, like, okay, now don't give me too much of that. Cause that's telling me things I don't believe about myself, you know, all of that nonsense. But after that show, I had not worked with a director again on a cabaret show until the second round of Brass Menagerie, when I realized I wrote a play in cabaret form. I mainly collaborate with Brian Nash, who's my music director. It's like the easiest collaborative process I've ever had. He's the other half of my creative brain. I never have to explain anything to him. I'm like, what about this? He's like, oh, yes. And what if we blah, 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 blah? I'm like, genius. And it's so fast. It's so easy. There's such trust. And I have found that a bit easier usually than working with the director, just because there's less explanation. I don't know. I feel like I have a pretty clear idea of what I want to do a lot of the time. And I find it exhausting having to constantly explain it to people. So I'm like super choosy about who I collaborate with, because I will let myself be, I don't know. I don't know if a doormat's quite the right word, but I will like put their needs first when it's like, well, you're the one on stage having to do the thing. So why don't you like figure out what you really want to do and then bounce the ideas off Brian. And then so for Brass Menagerie, the second round, when I realized like I need some help with this, I asked Andrew Neisler, who is one of the founding members of Fresh Ground Pepper. And he's just awesome and so funny. And like I knew he like got the vibe. I'd worked with him a couple times. So I was like, this is the guy that I want to bring in to help work on this, because he knows Williams and musical theater and knows the tone and knows he's going to help me hit it, you know. But yes, that was a roundabout way of answering your question, I think.
Yeah. So you were talking about how you felt when you left the stage that night after your first show. Flash forward to the next day. Was mm-hmm. there a sense that it was something you wanted to do more of and that sat extremely well on you? Like, did you have any sort of foresight that it was going to become a big part of your life, this kind of work?
I don't think I thought this is going to be a big part of my life, but I did feel like that went much better than I had expected. I really remember this huge wave of like peace. I woke up that next day just feeling so joyous and serene. I'm like getting emotional as I'm thinking about it. And I got an email from a college friend of mine that had come to the show and hadn't seen me perform in a number of years. And he was just like, I came expecting to see like wonderful Amy Jo that I've like always loved and always admired. And this was on a level that I could not have anticipated. And it really like blew me away. Like just all these kind things that made me like that in the immediate aftermath of like still being in the feeling of like that went really well, to hear that from someone who'd known me since I was barely 18 years old. Really like solidified for me in my mind, like you might be onto something here. And I definitely want to do that again. I don't know that I saw that as like the beginning of like me doing a bunch of acts, but I definitely felt like it, yeah, opened a door for me inside myself that was very healthy and very necessary for me. And I really think doing cabaret and to a certain extent like nightlife hosting and that sort of thing has given me a lot more confidence in like what I really am capable of and my creative brain and like the possibility of bringing joy to people lives within me, you know?
Do you feel like it helped your non-cabaret work?
Absolutely. Well, for one thing, I don't know. I'm so, especially in these times when we've had so much time to reflect lately, I'm really I feel like I'm at the end of continuing to define myself in disparate categories. I am an actor, and I am a cabaretist, and I am a singer, and I am a dialect coach, and I may be a writer. Like, enough. It's exhausting. And it's, I don't care if it's confusing to people anymore. I am a creator. I am a creative force. And that manifests in different ways, depending upon what I'm working on and what I am putting my attention toward at that moment. And I do believe that to a certain extent, it's cumulative. You know, my work as a dialect coach has absolutely helped my work as an actor. I'm more attentive to detail in certain ways because I've heard myself say it a million times to clients. You know, my work doing Shakespeare has helped when I do Sondheim. You know, like it's all just training different parts of yourself. It's like, well, today's leg day, you know, mm-hmm. and then tomorrow I'll do my arms. This is not how I work out, but I know some people do, you know, but so it's like, all right, so today I'm a cabaret artist. And then I need to think about things a little bit differently when I am like doing Fun Home, but doing a show like Fun Home, for instance, where you're basically alone on stage. Like, even if you're on a stage with other actors, you, the character, are alone on stage the whole time, and like having to maintain presence and ease within an audience that is like, you could touch them if you wanted to, you know, like that was all, I was so comfortable doing that show in a way that I don't know that every actor who's played that part would be. I don't know. I haven't talked to a ton of other people who've played it, but like for me, I'm like, I am super used to standing in front of an audience without a break for, I mean, that was like an hour 45 that show ran. I was like, this is, I'm coziest here. And that's partially because I'm used to staying in front of an audience for long periods of time and it being on me, you know, and I'm very comfortable with that. If I feel prepared, then that feels like the right place to be. And how can that not affect your confidence in other areas, you know?
Yeah, you're bringing a flashback for me as well in my first show, because I worked with a director. And I remembered in rehearsals that I would always start to, when we were running the whole show, start to give up on myself about halfway through. Mm. There was like something in my psyche that sort of said, you're interesting for half an hour, or you have half an hour of tricks. And then, and yeah, so conquering that really shifted things, I think. So you mentioned the night where you sang Accustomed to Her Face with Jen's
yes.
studio and Gender. 2 years later, you did an amazing show about gender. Tell me about that show.
Yes, it was called I Want to Be Your Man. And yeah, I don't know. I've been playing with gender since before. That's what I knew I was. That's what I was doing. You know, I've always been tall. I've always like, you know, as a kid, when there's like a million girls in the after school drama program and maybe one boy who often was my brother, you know, it's like I was playing a lot of male roles and I don't know. I always found it fun. Who cares? You know, I think also the acceptance from an early age that I was never the ingenue was very helpful to me. You know, I would watch Annie and of course I would still try to sit in my basically non-existent windowsill and sing maybe, but I would more often than not be found like with sponge rollers in my hair, like sitting at my bathtub singing Little Girls. Like, I wish I were making that up. It's true. My brother and I would play a game called Annie where we'd go to my grandmother's and like get a bucket of water and soap and we would scrub the floor. She loved, y'all want to play Annie? Because we would just like scrub the floor, but we would not be Annie, he would be Molly and I would be Pepper. We were like from the jump, like, I'm more interested in the tertiary characters. You know what I mean? So I've been playing parts that were not appropriate for my age or gender presentation for ever, you know? So I've always been interested in like playing around with it. Like I also did, I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face, I think in that first show that I did. I also did like a Tom Waits song. I've just always been interested in like, well, who cares? You know, like why not me if I have something to say with that material? Like, why should I shy away from it? Oh, I can't sing that? Why? Especially in cabaret. I mean, I'm not talking about race or like a minority. That's a very, very different conversation. But insofar as like gender, it's like, why shouldn't I sing that song? Who cares?
You did what? You know? Soliloquy, right? You did.
Yeah, let's see. That set list started with Stacey's Mom. and then I did Man from Full Monty. I did What's the one from Light in the Piazza? Love to Me, I did. I did The Smell of Rebellion, because although that is a female character, it's played by a man. It's always originally written to be played by a man. I have been in for that role. So I sang that. And then, yeah, I did an 11-minute medley called The Inevitable Sexist Medley, where I sang a bunch of sexist songs. And I got one critic said that it was too long. And I was like, I think you've missed the point. So when I did that show again, I added to it. I
made it yes.
longer. I was like,
I think that's the first time I've applauded on the podcast. I literally, I felt compelled to put my hands together and make sense.
I was like, this is, you did, okay. I did that. But yeah, then I did Soliloquy. I did this lovely mashup of If Ever I Would Leave You with the Chet Baker version of I Get Along Without You Very Well. Like, my brother had sent me that song being like, you should sing this song. And then, like, it ends with this beautiful lyric about, like, spring. And I was like, oh, this makes me think of If Ever I Would Leave You. And then I played that song. I was like, they're in the same key. Bada bing, bada boom. We got ourselves a mashup. And then, yeah, I closed with Wooden Box. There's a couple other songs I'm forgetting, but basically that. And it was so fun, you know. It's just like the one of the things that I hoped to highlight by doing that show was so many roles, at least in the musical theater canon, that are traditionally written for women are a little milquetoast. Like, they're not necessarily always as athletic in the, like, the language and the action behind them, you know, the agency. You know, there's all these male roles where men can sing about anything. I mean, I think that's actually a lot of this started because I was doing a lot of male roles in Shakespeare, and I was doing a lot of male Shakespeare monologues, and that's very acceptable, right? Like, people are, like, used to that. I can go into an audition room with Edmund, which I've done, and people don't bat an eye. You know, even, like, a really old school traditionalist would be like, I get it, you know? Mm-hmm. But, like, you go in with certain male songs to musical theater audition rooms, and it's a bit of a more, you're rolling the dice a bit more. But I'm also to a point where I'm like, I don't care. But I remember going to some night of, like, at this place where you can, like, go and, like, people get up and do Shakespeare monologues and get critiques. And I didn't, like, I raised my hand, but I didn't get picked for, there was only a few people that got to go up. And, like, afterwards, everyone goes out to the bar. And I was, like, staying at a high top, around a high top with, like, a bunch of other people, probably, like, six or seven other people. And, you know, people are, like, coming and going from the conversation because there's a ton of conversations happening. And at some point, and I didn't realize that this had happened, it was me and then a bunch of guys. And one of them asks, like, oh, well, why didn't you work tonight? I was like, well, I didn't get picked. He's like, oh, well, what would you have done? And I said, oh, I would have done Edmund, Thou Nature Art My Goddess. And they were like, oh, why would you want to do? And this was only, like, 2013 or something like that. It's not like it was that long ago, but they were like, why would you do that? Like, and not, you know, a girl monologue, you know? I was like, well, I really love the language, and start talking about the speech. And I was like, and I don't know, I really like playing with androgyny. And I will just never forget this moment, because I hadn't realized at this point it's just me and a bunch of guys, like, that's what this group had ebbed to. But this guy looks at me and kind of, like, in a way that he thought, I'm sure, was a compliment, kind of scoffs and goes, you think you're androgynous? Because, listener, I have curves, for those of you that don't know what I look like. So I looked at him and I was like, I think anytime someone who looks like a woman does a piece that is written for a man, there is an inherent androgyny in that. It is not about being flat-chested. I didn't say it's not about being flat-chested. That is my addition now. But I was just like, it's literally what androgyny is. It's like in between, friction between, like, perceived gender. And so it's like that sort of thing where I'm, like, standing at a bar with a bunch of, like, liberal people from New York who are actors who are, like, so clueless. You know, it's just like, well, this is stupid. I'm going to do what I want to do, and I'm going to do it loudly because I don't know. I'm tall. I feel like it's more acceptable on someone like me to do something like that. So why shouldn't I, like, go into, I went into an EPA shortly before everything shut down and sang those Canaan days because they said, they were doing Joseph and they were like, please bring in a song from, you know, they were doing Joseph in like some other show. They're like, please bring in a song for the character you'd like to be considered for. And I was like, you got it. You know, and I knew that they were probably not going to look at me. They're like, that was so fun. Thank you. I was like, you're welcome. Knowing I was not likely to get a call back or anything like that. But I was like, I'm going to do it because like, I want you to think about the fact that you don't have to cast this role with a guy just because that's the way it's been done. And because it is written as brother, like let's be a bit more malleable in our thinking about like what we might be able to say or represent, you know?
I have a bit of a chicken and an egg question because I was planning to ask you, did that show change your conversation about gender with yourself and with others? But hearing you speak, it sounds a little bit more to me like you almost had a thesis that you wanted to share with the world. Like what kind of, is that?
Yes, I would say I did not, this was not me making an album of songs that I don't normally get to sing. Let's put it that way. If I wanted to sing just songs that were traditionally sung by men, just that I might sound good on, it probably would have looked a little bit different. I wouldn't have done like Man from Full Monty. That's a fun song. But that to me was, you know, when there's a song called Woman from Pirate Queen, that is an embarrassment, you know, like, but the man song is funny and it has like a point of view and he gets to be someone who like is not fully a good guy, but he's our protagonist. You know, he lives in this gray area because he's a human being. But yet, you know, Grania in Pirate Queen is like, I am on a quest. I want to not merely be defined by my gender. And that's the whole thing. And I find it exhausting. And it's not, I'm not just purely like shitting on Pirate Queen. That is indicative of a whole
there's a lot of that
problem, you know? So, yeah, so it was a lot of my own personal experience and my own personal interests and it being like a natural thing that I'd have interest in working on. And when I did the show a second time, I had this friend of mine who's a burlesque artist and an incredible spandex artist as well, make me this wild cat suit that was like, I was like, I want it to be like Annie Lennox, Ziggy Stardust, like the wildest kind of like version of all of this, like that you can think of. I went like black and silver and blue and a big shiny collar. And it was such a, I don't know, it was super fun. Number one, to be like, oh, I'm now in the performing in cat suit stage of my career. This feels about right. You know, where it's like, oh, I hit a point where I was like, oh, I need to be more intentional with what I wear. If I'm thinking of things from like a nightlife perspective, from a musical theater perspective, you can get up and do a cabaret in a nice dress and you're fine. But I was like, I'm trying to say something more specific than that. So I need to do that from the moment I enter. Like people need to see that and take something more intentional in with the look, you know? So, and a friend of mine afterwards seeing the show in that outfit was like, oh man, watching it up there. It was like, I realized a person can be a drag queen and a drag king at the same time. And I was like, I feel like I've done my job here. That, you know, if like that was like something that I gave you like permission to see. And also if that's what you were reading on me, that's very exciting to me, you know, and also was like a testament to like, yeah, leveling up every aspect of what you're bringing in the room. My favorite cabaret artists are the look is always very particular. Like it's something that's like only Bridget Everett would be wearing these things. If you look at like drag artists, most drag artists aren't going to like come on stage in just anything. Like there's a whole look. And I think a lot of actors who do cabaret shows are just like, I'm going to wear a nice this. And that's fine. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But I like, for me, it's like, no. It has to be very intentional. Even if it's like a casual version of that, it's like, what am I saying with how I look that is additive to the entire experience? Again, it's a different aspect of curation. I'm curating an experience so that the visual experience is a journey, not just the emotional experience, not just the aural experience, you know, that it all feeds and accumulates.
What's the most challenging part of doing a solo show?
Selling it. I wish it was something profound, but it's that. It's butts in seats. It is a constant source of strife. Truly, every time I do a cabaret show. We get to about 2 days out and I am cursing. I am cursing the gods of Olympus. You know, I'm like, why? Why did I do this to myself? I'll never do another solo show. And then we do it and it's fun and people show up, or not as many as I'd hoped, or we sell out unexpectedly. You know, Brass Menagerie, I was like, I'm going to do 3 dates on, you know, over the course of 2 weeks. And I had a lot of trouble selling that first day. And then the second week, I mean, there was still like enough at the duplex, is also nice and small. So like it still feels full, you know, but I was taping over the next two, like from the back, but I was still taping and I was like, oh gosh, I want there to be people there. And so like I comped a few people into the Thursday show, including Adam Feldman, who, you know, was not there to review it. He is a critic for Time Out New York, but he really loved the show, wrote about it on his personal Facebook that night. And the next day we were sold out because within 2 hours, everyone that's friends of Adam was like, well, I want to go see that if it's good. And I was like, oh, great. Well, now I wish I had 2 more dates. I could have sold them out, you know, but it's exhausting. It's exhausting. And you're like selling yourself and you're also feel like you're like begging your friends to come see you perform. And even if they like you, sometimes your friends are like, ah, I've seen it, you know, and I get it.
It's stressful. You know, it's like all the build up to the night.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember in my first show, we sold, I mean, the amount of people that came was like, I think 4 times as many as the reservations.
If I know I am going to see someone's solo show or like a duo show or something like that, if I know like, oh, I'm going to that, I buy a ticket earlier because
you know, because you've done it. Yes.
I know. I'm just like, all right, great. They know they have at least one reservation, you know?
And yet I've been so guilty of not doing that, you know, because you get it. You're like, well, I'm going to go, but I don't know if I'm going to go on Friday or I'm going to go on Saturday.
Yeah.
You know,
I just pick a date and I do it. And then luckily, like I know people at enough venues that if I need to change it, it's not that hard to do, because I have like, because I'm also a very good audience member. I mean, the work is a joy, you know, and the great thing about cabaret is if it's like, I just can't make this song work, you put something else in, you know, like you just solved the problem. But it's not like I have to figure out how after singing this really low song, I can now belt this song. It's like, you know what, I got to take the low song out. I got to find something else to fill it because it's just not technically setting me up for success. So how do I make sure that I can get through this without like going through like a humiliation spiral in the middle of a show in front of however many people. But yeah, on the whole, the work is a joy. It's just trying to get people there to see it who are then seemingly quite happy they attended.
Right, right. What's the greatest cabaret performance you've ever seen?
I've seen a lot of really amazing cabaret artists. I'd say maybe my favorite show I've ever seen was Salty Brine, who is incredible. He does this thing called the Living Record Collection, where basically he'll take an album and sing it straight through. Like that is the conceit. So every show is a different album. But he will then create a story around the album. And often he'll be doing like arrangements around, like deep arrangements around all the songs, so that it's like this magical journey. So I saw the first show of his. The album was Laura Nero's Eli and the 13 Confessions. I now know, because I've seen like 3 of Salty's shows, that he always has like a different MD, a different band, like a different director, because he's trying to get a vibe that matches that album. For the Laura Nero show, he set it in ancient Rome and made this whole story, this like, it ended up being like both super gay and the story of the first Christmas. Like, I can't explain how we got there, but that was such an example of like, wow, if you just like chase what's inside your head to like the nugget of what it is you're trying to say through this material, what a payoff you can have, you know? It really just taught me a lot about, because I was also writing Brass Menagerie at that time when I saw it, and it really gave me a strong sense of confidence that it's like, I'm doing a very different thing, but that's what I'm trying to do with this. I would also say, for old school cabaret, you can't beat Marilyn May. She's like probably 93 now. I mean, she's just, She's so great. And I think the reason why, even though she's in her 90s and doing this very old school version of cabaret, the reason she is still like, she's having this renaissance and is still so fresh is because she's so present with the audience, because she knows how to work a crowd and she is happy to be there. And she's not just like rolling out the same old stuff. She's like still actively investigating and trying to curate a great time for everyone there. And it's like, well, you know, if it works, it works. You know, she's not just singing a bunch of nice songs she knows she sounds good on. She's like giving you a show.
It's intentional. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the cabaret-esque project you're doing now.
Oh, yes.
Escatol. I can't describe it, but you hopefully can.
I shall. Yes. Okay. So Escaton is basically an immersive digital nightclub. We started in April of last year. We were like the first ones on the scene, and it started as like a one-off, and then people really liked it. And so they decided to build it out into a weekly show. So then in like mid-May, we started doing it weekly. Now it is twice monthly. There's some like private events, that sort of thing. And we'll do like, we did a New Year's show. We did a Valentine's Day show. We are taking the month of April off to come back because we're kind of reconfiguring the show now that we've been running for a year, to be like, okay, now how can we like be more intentional with the storytelling and this sort of thing? So we have a new director. When I say gone through, I don't mean in a bad way, but we've gone through, there's been three different directors attached to the project over the course of it as we've tried to craft these different kinds of experiences. So this is our third director. But yeah, basically, the audience receives a Zoom link an hour before, and then you can like go to this page where there's a countdown clock, and then at Escaton is open for 1 hour only, so from like 10 to 11 on many a Saturday night, Eastern Standard Time. You then click the link and a little video appears sort of explaining what's happening. And then the video is over and three doors appear. You can hover over them, sometimes four, and they each have a name. And you can click on the door and it will take you to a Zoom room where a performer is doing something. So those are the host rooms. I'm usually in one of those host rooms. Britta Filter, who's a very fabulous, well-known drag queen, is usually in one of those. People can sit in those rooms, go back to the homepage and go to one of the other of the four rooms. Or you can sit and wait until a stage manager, because yes, we have like four stage managers a night on this project because it takes that many to run this whole thing. They will drop in the chat a list of room names and then these words that are the keys, basically. So it's like, I'm in the mirror box is the name of my room. So then if it were to appear in someone else's chat, it would be like the mirror box. And then the code would be mirror. And then you go back to the homepage and there's a little box where you can enter that word. And then that will close that Zoom meeting and take you to another one where you might see a burlesque artist. You might see a pole dancer. You might see a contortionist. You might see a guy who is like a sexy half-clothed juggler who is then playing guitar for you. Like you'll see dancers like doing like free form interp, that kind of stuff. And you can kind of try and go see all of them. Now at this point we have a lot of regulars, so I'll have people who will just camp in my room for a good half an hour or 45 minutes. Like you find your favorites. And it's been really interesting to do a cabaret show digitally. Like we were talking about before about making eye contact with performers, when you're working on Zoom with gallery view, like right now I'm looking directly into your eyes, but like if there were three other people in this meeting, it would not look like I was looking at everyone. Whereas if I'm staring, and I have like a camera that they've sent me, so if I'm staring directly down the barrel, it looks like I'm looking at everyone. So when I'm doing my crowd work in between songs, I will be in gallery view, like looking at people and talking to people that way, because obviously that's how I can see them and like see their names and comment to them that way. But then when I'm singing, everything is at this one spot. So weirdly, it is like the thing I don't like to do in person, but to have the same effect that it would have in person as like actually looking a person dead in the eye. It's been really fun for some songs. Man, it's been really great because you can play with intimacy in a whole new way. You know, I do Is That All There Is every show, which is a song I've been doing since that first cabaret show. And like, I get in real close for one of those, you know, I'm just staring down the camera, just basically like, just try not to blink, Amy Jo, you know, and then like, do this whole thing, but then I can like pull away and pull back. And then I'm like, oh, I've let you see too much. You know, like you can do that in a much more direct way than you could on stage. You know, you can't get that close to every audience member when you're on stage. So I found cool stuff out of it. It is obviously not ideal, but I think it's been really fun. Also, like, there's people from all over the world who watch it. You know, I've like connected with people that I'm now like friendly with who like live mm-hmm. in California, or like we have regulars from Brazil who come, and like people who would never have seen me perform before. And now it's like we get to share space together with some frequency. And it's really been exciting.
Yeah, that's so nice. Because this kind of work definitely is not done everywhere, even in lots of places that have all sorts of other kinds of
art stuff. That's exactly right. Yeah.
But yeah, that sounds so cool. I definitely have to check that out. And I will put it in the show notes if anyone wants to check it out.
Great.
I will also put in the show notes your podcast with Jeff. Tell us about that.
Yes. So my partner, Jeff, has wanted to do this podcast about casting, like film casting, for a few years now. And then when lockdown happened and I was going to be getting some mics because I started writing music, and I was like, I'm going to need to be doing demos. Like, all this kind of coincided with lockdown. Like, I was already thinking about doing some of this stuff. And then I was like, well, I have the time. So he was like, well, what about starting this podcast and you can be my co-host? And I was like, okay, I've realized it's just an elaborate ruse to get me to sit down and watch movies with him, but it's gonna be really fun to do. So yeah, we'll watch a movie and he'll do all the research and I will just watch the movie. So this also works great for me because I don't have to do all of the hardcore research. And we'll talk about the film, and then we'll talk about mostly it'll be the principal actors for whom he can find information about there being other actors up for those roles. So like, for instance, we did Thelma and Louise late last year, and there were so many other people up for those roles. And we will talk about, like, do we think that works? Would that have absolutely ruined the movie? Gosh, would that have made it better? Oh, wait, if that, you know, there's a lot of roles where like one actor will have read for one part and wound up in another role. And we'll be like, can you imagine that? Or how would that have affected this or that? And it's really fun. And we'll suggest people that we would like to see in those parts. And it's been really fun. It's like movie nerd trivia coming from two actors as well. So it's like coming from people who know what it takes to like do the job. We've had a really good time, and we're very silly. It's not like the absolute most research in the world. So, you know, it's a lot of banter and silliness. And Jeff and I are both very goofy people. And I do think our dynamic comes across fairly clearly the show.
It's really fun. I really encourage everyone to check it out.
Oh, thanks.
Amy Jo, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Denis. I could talk about Cabaret for conservatively 2 days solid. So thanks for giving me the chance.
Well, is there anything else you want to say before we sign off? And it doesn't have to be about Cabaret. Anything on your mind at all you want to share with the world or whoever is listening to this at this moment? Who's still listening? Thank you if you're still listening.
Thank you for listening to the end. Yeah, I don't know. Go see things that you don't necessarily know what they are. Don't just go see, like, Cheetah Rivera do a cabaret. Because while Cheetah Rivera is wonderful, and I've seen that show, and she's tremendous, like, you're going to get different things from seeing somebody like, I don't know who this is, but, like, they play Joe's Pub all the time. People seem to go see them. Maybe I should check out Bridget Everett. Maybe I should check out, I mean, I'm naming people who are, like, huge downtown fixtures. Like, to say Bridget Everett, people are like, duh, if they know anything about cabaret, or Taylor Mack, or Salty Brian, or Molly Pope, you know. There's so many artists that are brilliant that you probably don't know about that might bring you a tremendous amount of joy and make you feel a lot of things and think differently about songs you know or your life. So I'd just say, you know, poke around different venues and go see things that sound even vaguely interesting when that is possible, because also we are going to be in desperate need of people coming to see shows in order to keep some of these venues afloat. So if you're able to, you know, go support. Also, like, this is a thing that I don't think we talk enough about. It is actually pretty easy to support a lot of artists without spending any money by simply subscribing to their YouTube channels, their Instagrams, liking and saving their posts. You know, if you like someone's music, I mean, if you have Apple Music, just download it. Just subscribe to this podcast. Post about it. It can cost you nothing but like a slide in your Instagram story, but it could have a really big effect cumulatively for that artist. And I don't think we talk enough about how easy it can be on like a something that seems so small can have like a big effect if enough people do that sort of thing. So if you like somebody, show them online, you know?
I love that. Listener, if you enjoy Amy Jo singing online, or if you enjoy her and Jeff's podcast, or you enjoy this podcast, maybe put us in a story, tag us, tell us you love it, and
Denis, you know, a 5-star rating and review. Like, you know, help the man out.
Thank you. But, you know, also, I relate beyond cabaret. Like, it's so healthy to go beyond your normal viewing habits. And in this pandemic, I've really realized that for a number of reasons, partly because I'm in a relationship now where he wants to watch things different than I do. So I've ended up watching all these things I would never watch. I've made a point to watch less white-driven things. Because of this podcast, and especially recently, obviously I know you, I've been really challenging myself to interview a lot of people I've never met, which also means I'm researching hundreds of people.
Yeah.
And so even though the vast majority of them I haven't talked to or I haven't talked to yet, I just can't believe how many incredible people are out there that I didn't know about and have different sensibilities. And, you know, I had Addison Fry, who I think you know. And we had a really interesting conversation about music that way too, that if you're only listening to a certain kind of music, that will show up in your music.
It's impossible for it not to.
So there's a lot there. There's a lot there.
Yeah.
You are a gem. You are brilliant.
Oh gosh, thanks. I love you.
I adore you. Amy Jo fans, I hope you enjoyed that. And if you don't know her,
get
into it. You won't regret it. Love you.
And that was my episode with Amy Jo Jackson. I'm putting all of Amy Jo's links in the show notes, their YouTube, their Instagram, and definitely check out their Patreon. For a very small amount a month, you can be one of Amy Jo's supporters and help them continue this cabaret work that we chatted about on the episode today. Thanks again to Amy Jo for coming on the show. Amy Jo has so much to say about cabaret. Amy Jo's so good at cabaret. And it's really a special thing. And I think New York cabaret is a special thing. Amy Jo's so right that there are so many artists out there that we don't know about. I fully admit I didn't know who Bridget Everett was, but I have now Googled her. And I look forward to seeing her and hopefully lots of cabaret performers in a real live space, drinks and laughter and people very, very soon. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week. Bye.